Good evening, everyone. You're listening to CITR at 101.9 FM, broadcasting from UBC's unceded Musqueam territory. Thank you for tuning into today's episode of Intersections, CITR's biweekly radio show about feminism, gender empowerment, and bringing down the patriarchy, all of which are in a day's work for the small but powerful team we have here at CITR. We air every other Tuesday from 4 to 5 p.m., so make sure you tune in then for some woke conversations and content. It seems incredibly easy these days to offend people, both in real life and on social media. Of course, considering just how much people are hooked onto social media these days, including myself, the line between real life and social media is getting quite blurry. And out of all social media sites, Twitter seems to be particularly a hotbed for moral outrage. It seems really hard for celebrities or politicians or any famous personality, really, to say the right thing. Everything is held under intense scrutiny, and most nearly everything offends some portion of the population. Even the world of comedy, a profession that was once considered to have a free pass when it came to touchy subjects, also seems to be slowly saturating with political correctness. But the real question is, are we going too far? Is this culture of political correctness actually becoming more harmful than helpful to genuine discourse about important conversations about sex, gender, race, immigration, or religion? Now, that's what the next hour of Intersections is going to be dedicated to today. I'm joined in the studio by Carol, Jasmine, and Danielle.
Hi.
We're also going to call a Vancouver-based comic and artist, Jackie Heffart, to talk about outrage culture in the world of comedy. And, of course, play some neat music that we have lined up just in case this is getting a little too intense for you. So, Carol and Jasmine, you guys went around town and asked strangers what they thought about political correctness culture. And before I play the clip that you guys brought for us, can you tell us a little bit about what that experience was like? Were you surprised by any of the answers?
Yeah, I was, actually. The straighter was interesting because I initially went in thinking that people were going to give me these extreme answers, and it wasn't going to be very productive, and I was going to offend a lot of people, but people were genuinely interested in actually expressing their opinions, and there was a diverse range of opinions on PC culture. So it was actually quite a positive experience for me.
Yeah, I think we got a diverse range of voices and opinions. We decided to do it downtown so that we could figure out whether these conversations were different outside of campus as well.
Cool. All right. Here is the clip that they brought for us.
How do you think political correctness is affecting how we speak about race and culture?
I feel that perhaps people are a little bit more conscientious of how they're speaking so as to not use, you know, let's say rude slang terms. And it's bringing it into the forefront of people's minds, and as a result, maybe being, just a lot more conscientious and not as, not following as many, like, stigmas and using these terms in an impolite manner. People are being a little bit more aware of what they're saying when they're talking. Some people for that matter. Other people perhaps are pushing it the other way. You kind of get a little bit more of this, the split, you know, the more something is in somebody's face, maybe perhaps like the more they want to push back. So as a result, you might have the other sort of thing happening. But I feel like it's a little bit more at the forefront of people's minds.
My name is Thomas Stanley. I think it could go both ways. It could be quite subjective. I think when you're being politically correct, I think you try to avoid some certain truths. And a lot of truths are found in areas that are quite messy, so to speak. So if we're always trying to be politically correct, we're trying to mold ourselves into something that we might not be, and that could get in the way of something that is about truth.
What do you mean by truth?
Truth as in, you know, real feelings towards race and gender and whatever the issue might be, you know. To be politically correct on something, you're trying to appease and you're trying to kind of smooth things over and try not to rock the boat when some things are meant to be, when some truths and when they're meant to be talked about, they do rock the boat, and it makes things messy, and that's good, you know? It challenges us on what our views and our standpoint is.
Political correctness has become
a way to stifle progressive discussion, I think. Sometimes you have to say stuff that, I don't know, isn't going to be considered politically incorrect to actually make a progressive political progress. I don't know, just not being able to bring up contentious like talking points because of the politically correct atmosphere, I think gets nothing done. And we have to remember that we don't live in a vacuum of like left-wing students. We live in a world where our rights are being, well, people are trying to take away our rights, basically. And we need to, you know, sometimes not be so politically correct in trying to defend those rights.
I feel like if people just, like, didn't have the same kind of people on all their social media, because that's where everyone kind of seems to get their news nowadays, you wouldn't really have a standard for anything being politically correct. Because, like, different people would find different things politically correct. So what would you say then? I just, like, feel like people should try to have, associate themselves with different kinds and, like, not close themselves off like that. Because it closes conversation, too.
How do you think being politically correct is affecting the way we speak about race and culture?
I think that the rise of the political correctness dialogue at the very least has created a space to talk about issues and topics that have been swept under the rug and allows us to better understand one another's identities. Because at the end of the day, people don't fit into camps, and I think that those who are angered by the emergence of the PC dialogue ultimately feel threatened by the prospect of change that might result without considering the roots of basic human empathy.
Want to be politically correct, right? Like, if we're like afraid to like say, you know, something specific, then it's like, okay, well, I'm not gonna like share my opinion, or at least that's what it is for me. Like, I don't want to, I'm so, you know, concerned about hurting someone's feelings or just like.
All right, that was a lot of quite a lot of different opinions in there. Actually, I was expecting most people to say that, you know, talk about how political correctness is actually very beneficial, but it seems like that's not entirely the case.
Yeah, I think if we are choosing to get all of our answers from a place like Twitter, we might have sort of a very narrow understanding of how the public actually feels about it, right? Twitter is only about 200 million users, and that's a tiny representative sample of the population. And it very much is this sort of echo chamber, right? If we're only talking to people who agree with us, we're not actually advancing any kind of dialogue. But at the same time, Twitter is also this very polarizing place online where it seems like outrage culture really prevails, and these discussions can be kind of stifled, which I think somebody mentioned in the clip. I was just going to open up the discussion. Do you guys think that outrage culture makes conversations more difficult?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I mean, I only speak for myself when I talk about, like, coming from a conservative background and, like, a really religious family. I do feel like sometimes when I just see the outrage around certain things regarding political correctness, I just feel kind of hesitant to ask some really important questions that I feel I shouldn't be hesitating while asking. And yeah, I think like when it comes to a point like that where you kind of are losing the meaning of a lot of these conversations within mm-hmm. this outrage surrounding it. Mm-hmm. And so yeah, I do feel like in some ways, like I do feel like we really need to draw a line, like what is the appropriate level of like, can you get charged up too much over something, or mm-hmm. are you doing more harm? Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think there's just some things that we should probably be thinking about.
And I really resonate that. And it kind of ties back into what Jasmine was saying earlier about kind of the polarization of beliefs and opinions on Twitter. Because I feel like it's human nature to have uncomfortable questions and want to ask those icky questions. But all those things eventually impact how we view, you know, any kind of topic, whether it's gender, race, immigration, religion, whatever, right? And I feel like what the polarization on Twitter is doing, like hardcore left-leaning but not really liberalism, is just kind of forcing people to hide their true prejudices instead of like airing out their dirty laundry and, you know, just talking about it and then leading to more fruitful conversations. So I think that's definitely harming those kind of conversations.
And I just also want to put it out there that, like, I feel like we as like a people, like the world is kind of growing when it comes to conversations around race, mm-hmm. gender, and sexual identity. Mm-hmm. And I feel like in a time like this, if you're only going to make these spaces even more uncomfortable mm-hmm. for people who mm-hmm. are not that educated, mm-hmm. then I feel like you're either going to stop the growth altogether mm-hmm. or you're going to limit the speed at which the world's going to grow.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah, I mean, these conversations are difficult as it is. And if we're going to bring outrage around it, then it's going to be even more difficult.
Yeah, there's no question that there's definitely some barriers to participating and some barriers to entering these conversations without feeling like you may be sort of exposing yourself to a possible attack, right? Danielle, you said that, you know, sometimes you have questions. Sometimes you don't have the full picture. Sometimes you come from a background that doesn't necessarily have those conversations and you're just coming from a place of curiosity. I know that some people feel that the PC culture and this dialogue online and the genuine discourse sometimes isolates those who are just trying to learn. And it kind of prevents those from having those educational moments that I think we can all benefit from. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, we are trying to create a more tolerant society. And if we are going to be angry at those who don't understand us when they are trying to understand us, I don't think that's actually very productive. So I think, as you said, it is a fine line.
Yeah, totally. From like even a personal experience, like the classroom itself can be very, at times, hostile when we are approaching certain kinds of topics. So even for me, I'm taking a course called Reporting Indigenous Communities, and truthfully, I don't really know much about Indigenous communities in Canada, specifically because my education was not very focused on that. Mm-hmm. And so coming in with this lack of knowledge, I am very wary of how I speak about these marginalized communities and the language around them. But because I'm afraid of being called out and being called ignorant, when really I'm just trying to learn, the PC culture is almost crippling for me to speak out about how I feel or what I even just want to know about specific communities.
Because we don't live in a vacuum, right?
No.
If we want to interact with different orientations and identities, we have to be able to ask the questions so we can actually interact with different people, right?
Yeah. And I feel like PC culture, there are certain elements where some people who are more educated want to maybe voice that they are or they're less ignorant than other people. And so it kind of comes off as being, they do want to educate us, but it comes off angry. And so it kind of amplifies our fear in kind of speaking this way.
Yeah, I've been in situations where a potential learning moment was turned into a really angry confrontation. People sometimes they have the best of intentions, and sometimes when they slip up or say something wrong, if that is met with anger on an opposing side, that misplaced emotion, the passion of why don't you understand this? How dare you say something so offensive? I think it isolates that person from growing from that moment, really. And I notice this when I speak to people from older generations than I, where they were not sort of well-versed in these conversations and how language is actually a very powerful tool to reveal how we may or may not feel about certain people. Does anybody have any feelings about the power of language, especially as it relates to political correctness?
Oh, I mean, yeah, definitely. I feel like words have such a huge impact on the way a person is going to view themselves. And if you're going to put labels on a community, then, I mean, you can be assured that there is going to be a real big impact on the kind of words that you are using to describe them. So, yeah, I mean, these terms when referring to sexual identities, gender, or
even ethnicities, I think.
Yeah.
There are certain derogatory terms applied to people of certain countries that...
Absolutely,
yeah.
And so I feel like the reason that these terms keep on evolving, it's because people understand the effect of words.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I do completely agree with Jasmine on this, that words and language has a huge impact on the way people form identities and just see themselves.
And talking about that moment of education, that moment of learning, I mean, I feel like with the Gillette ad and that whole controversy and outrage that's been on Twitter since the past week. I mean, what started out as essentially a really great learning moment, I think, has been turned into something far more, I think, uglier and almost childish, I think. What do you guys think about that?
Yeah, I wanted to bring up the Gillette advertisement for a lot of reasons, because I know that that is one of the things that's been spoken about a lot online, and it's been super polarizing, actually. For those who haven't seen it, Gillette came out with an advertisement, I think last week it was, that took an unusual approach by sort of addressing the Me Too movement and attempting to call out toxic masculinity. It did so by featuring entirely men in the advertisement, all of whom were meant to hold each other accountable about things like bullying, assault, harassment, and it features men sort of stopping their peers from engaging in these harmful behaviors and teaching their peers how to not belittle others and to encourage their male friends to show compassion for victims of the Me Too movement and all of these very productive things. And if you speak to any women about this ad, it seems like the general consensus is that this is a very positive message that is long overdue. We always talk about how women are involved in the Me Too movement and are participating in this advocacy, but we rarely hold men accountable. And for an advertisement to call out men, mm-hmm. I think that was a really great choice. But however, the men's rights activists of Twitter reacted really strongly to this advertisement. They did not like to be called out. They thought they did not deserve to be held accountable. And the response was very defensive. And in my opinion,
What exactly do you think upset them?
I think they didn't want to be called out. They thought, hey, if I've never done anything wrong, mm-hmm. why should I be lumped into the category of men? And men right. have been demonized.
So there was like a generalization that they kind of felt was taking place.
Yeah, they thought it was unfair. Mm-hmm. And I've spoken to different men about the topic as well. And they said, you know, no, I've never engaged in any of these activities. So why do I deserve to be called out about it? And it's like, that's not the point. You should be grateful that we are trying to spread this message to a younger generation of boys mm-hmm. to not bully, to not harass, to not engage in toxic masculinity. And, you know, make no mistake, this advertisement was calling for inclusion and for, you know, encouraging your peers to be kinder and more tolerant to one another and not to be toxic to each other.
Right. The weird thing about the ad, and Carol and Danielle, tell me what you guys think. I mean, the reason I was confused a little bit about the kind of the outrage at the supposed generalization of the ad was that if you actually watch the ad, it's not that every male actor in the ad is kind of perpetrating and a kind of an act.
Right.
There are also men in there who are kind of stopping their friends from, hey, man, like, don't touch her like that.
Exactly.
Or don't say that. So obviously there's no generalization going on. It obviously acknowledges there are men out there who
are doing this great work.
Exactly. And that they're not the perpetrators. They're not the bad guys. So either the people who were outraged did not see the ad at all, or they just kind of saw like the first 5 seconds and just decided to get mad and start like a complete tirade.
Yeah, which is upsetting because for those who got upset about the ad, that ad was made for you, actually. It was mm-hmm. made for the people who are, you know, trying not to see the obvious here, which is that men need to hold each other accountable. It is a learning moment and an educational moment as much for women as it is for men. And mentorship is very, very important. And I think the way that people reacted to it kind of took away from that message. And that's the idea of, is outrage culture sort of taking away from really important discussions? What do you guys think about that?
Well, when I first watched the advertisement, the first thing that struck me was, and I might completely be projecting my own views onto this, but I feel like the perpetrators in the ads, they were predominantly white men. And I wonder if the reason that there is such an outrage is because the ad is almost kind of presenting this idea that, like, white men are only the perpetrators. Like, yes, in the actual ad, there were maybe two men of color who were contributing to toxic masculinity. But for the most part, they were all white men. And the ones who were stopping these kinds of actions were almost always black. So I wonder if even race like came into this and white men felt like they were being attacked as opposed mm-hmm. to just men as a political body. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys have any thoughts.
That's interesting.
On that.
I actually didn't notice that at all. I
don't think I noticed that.
Yeah,
either.
Me neither.
That's interesting.
No, that's an interesting take on the ad, actually. Yeah.
I mean, now that's like a whole other dimension of like yeah. outrage. Is like there's gender and now there's like race.
Yeah, so people have been boycotting Gillette, essentially, because of this ad, which I find super interesting. Mm-hmm. They think it, you know, it's some sort of political statement
right.
to boycott a company that is simply telling them to continue being a better person and to encourage your peers to be a better person. And it's very upsetting that that message was lost on so many people.
I mean, Danielle, like, as a man, how did you feel when you watched the ad, and what was your own response to that?
Oh, I actually loved the ad. I think it's a really powerful statement to just, I think what I took from it is that the ad called for a lot of men to become better allies,
to a lot of these people. And when I do think about it, I mean, as Jasmine pointed out, that a lot of men that she talked to were like, I've never done this, so why am I being held accountable? Yeah, I mean, maybe you haven't done this, but have you been a good ally? Have you stopped someone who was doing something like that? Or have you tried to send a better message to the younger generation or something like that? And yeah, I feel like, and also this just sentiment that kind of comes out where people just take it as a personal attack on their own character. I mean, guys, chill out. Not everybody is like that. Everybody acknowledges that. So when an ad shows men doing that, it also shows men, like you guys pointed out, stopping them.
That. Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, I mean, just being outraged as being like, oh, this is a general attack on the entire men of the world. I feel like that's kind of taking it a little bit too far. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and I do feel like with the controversy surrounding the ad, it takes a lot away from the actual message that the ad was trying to project.
I think that's a good, honestly, takeaway from the whole Gillette thing. I feel like there was definitely a message there that people missed, and as I'm sure there are many men out there who share your opinion. On that note, guys, we're just going to take a quick ad break. You're listening to Intersections at CITR at 101.9 FM. Stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
CITR and Mint Records have released their biannual collab, Pop Alliance Volume 5. This glamorous record features staple Vancouver artists Devours, Swim Team, Lord Fuckerman, Chris Horrific, and so many more. Get your copy for only $15 on iTunes or at the Mint Records store now.
I take my life. I want you all to take your life. I want you all to have your life. UBC Theatre and Film presents Lion in the Streets, directed by MFA candidate Michelle Thorne, telling the story of Isabel, the ghost of a murdered 9-year-old Filipina. Returning to the neighborhood 17 years after her death, young Isabel drops into the lives of her neighbors and reveals the hauntingly raw underbelly of human nature. Ultimately hopeful, Judith Thompson's seminal play, Lion in the Streets, devours with devastating beauty. Running January 17 to February 2nd at the TELUS Studio Theatre in the Chan Center for the Performing Arts, student tickets only $11.50 at theaterfilm.ubc.ca.
Welcome back, guys. That was a pretty short break. You're listening to Intersections at CITR at 101.9 FM. So for those who are just tuning in, we've been talking about outrage culture, political correctness, and social media. And speaking of outrage culture, the Kevin Hart controversy was pretty big. It kind of blew up on Twitter, like most things do on Twitter, a while ago. And for those of you who don't know, essentially, Kevin Hart had made a homophobic, well, actually, it was a homophobic tweet.
A series of homophobic tweets that
he sent out, I think, about 10 years ago. And on the day that it was announced that he was going to host for the Oscars, someone with admittedly too much time on their hands searched through all of his tweets, found that, and kind of blew that up on Twitter. And Kevin Hart allegedly said that he did apologize for that 10 years ago, and then he came on to Ellen talking about how he did apologize, and he did apologize again on Ellen. And people, I guess, were just, they felt like this kind of ruined his credibility as a comedian and as an ally for the LGBTQ2+ community. Yeah, so we are actually going to call Jackie Heffart, who's a Vancouver-based comic and artist. She runs Foxhole Comedy together with her wife every Wednesday in the projection room above the Fox Cabaret for those who frequent the cabaret. And her lineup generally centers the stories of women, gender non-binary folks, people of color, and queers. Now, before we call Jackie, do you guys have any thoughts you want to share about the Kevin Hart situation?
I think it's an interesting reaction because it's just one of those examples of what political correctness has changed. I think the landscape of comedy is completely different now. Now that we are joking about different things, we are laughing at things that are different. We are not, we're kind of moving away from the type of comedy that is at the expense of marginalized people, which is, of course, a really great thing. So I'm curious to know what Jackie's thoughts are on what how comedy has sort of shifted amongst all of this.
As a former Kevin Hart fan, when I found out about the scandal, it really, I don't want to say broke my heart, but it did disappoint me because I feel like he was part of a generation of comedians whose humor, like Jasmine has said, was very different from now. A lot of the jokes were targeted towards marginalized groups, and at the time when he was really at the peak of his career, we all found it funny. At least I did, anyway. And now it's almost like I do regret that I found that kind of humor funny, but because we were in a certain environment, a certain time, really, that really appreciated that kind of humor, it's just saddening almost to just realize like how backwards, quote unquote, we were back then. And Kevin Hart, I think he's definitely learned from that those past experiences. I mean, a lot of us have tweeted certain things out, and like Lakshmi said, some people just really enjoy bringing down celebrities who have, you know, tweeted out some things that are questionable. But we have to offer them certain spaces where they can just recognize that they made these mistakes and then move on.
Yeah, for sure, because I feel like some of the things that make this a very gray area for me is the fact that this happened 10 years ago. And if you look at, and I like Kevin Hart, I like his humor, and I don't want to get into the conversation of, can you separate the art from the artist? I don't want to get into that now, but I still like Kevin Hart. I think he's a funny guy. And what he said 10 years ago was definitely wrong. And I feel like since then, since those jokes, he, if you look at his stand-up specials, he hasn't made any homophobic content or any kind of joke. So now it's a question of, okay, he made those comments and apparently he apologized for it. But he's changed. Like, in action, he's changed. Does that not count for anything?
Yeah, I think the only sort of one of the most redeeming things he was able to say on Ellen was, I have been, like, enacting my apology for the last decade. As you said, Lakshmi, he is not real. To my knowledge, he hasn't been joking about those sorts of things in his comedy at all or in his movies. I'm not, like, I think Kevin Hart is funny, but I don't know his, I'm not very well versed. But I think that's the most that you can really expect from somebody is if they've made questionable decisions in the past, how have they changed in the present, in the future? And this idea of canceling somebody, right? You're going to cancel them as soon as they've done something wrong or if they've said something wrong. There is something to be said about where our culture was at 10 years ago. It's very different very from different. Where our culture is at today. So I think that when we have these conversations, we need to sort of add a dose of leniency when we
and
are
context
talking.
Too. And context. It's like, when did he make those jokes? It was not like he was the only one making it. It was very common. Yes.
Exactly. It doesn't, to single him out, I think would be a disservice because it was something that we were collectively sort of responsible for. And it's shameful to look back on. I don't enjoy, you know, watching these old movies that I used to find really funny, or even like if you watch an episode of Friends lately, it's like, wow, these jokes would not be made today.
They were
and
racist.
For a reason. Their jokes are transphobic, homophobic, all of the things, you name it. And I'm grateful for the growth is what I'm going to say.
and what you said earlier, Jasmine, and Danielle, you can jump in anytime. What you said about looking back, I realize it's shameful. That sentence, I think that's the operative sentence, looking back. Because in hindsight, not just Kevin Hart, a lot of the stuff we've done, even though most of us, well, I'm assuming everyone's like 24, 25 in this room. When you look back, of course, there's so many things in your life that you think is shameful in terms of what you've said or what you've done, right? And I feel like the weird thing about social media is, the people who kind of attack these people pretend like they've never said or done like a racist, homophobic, transphobic thing in their life. Like as if Kevin Hart is the only one who's ever said that. And like we're all angels sitting here who have the right to attack him. That's another kind of weird thing about social media. We all suddenly become like justice givers.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
There needs to be like sort of this collective accountability for sure. If we're going to have these conversations, we need to recognize our own actions and how we've played a role in perpetuating that culture, even within our own circles.
For sure. And on that note, let's try dialing Jackie Heffard. Guys, you got to be patient with us a little bit here. We're trying to dial a number.
Daniel, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, just keep talking while I dial this number.
I kind of feel like you guys pretty much nailed it with the whole thing and all. But yeah, I think when it comes to the whole incident, I was kind of disappointed. Okay, I think we're in the call now, so see you guys later.
Oh, it's ringing. It's ringing. Hello, Jackie?
No, you called
Madeline. I'm gonna it seems like guys, our soundboard's acting up a little bit. We're gonna cut the call and try that again. Yes, please.
Daniel, any other thoughts?
Yeah, keep talking. Daniel, entertain our listeners for a while we fix this.
Yeah, so I mean, yeah, I think when the whole thing kinda unfolded and just kind of like Kevin Hart's stubbornness at first, when he kind of just kept talking like, you know, I have apologized for this and I've given countless explanations about this, and I feel like that was kind of the kind of make or break moment for him, and that kind of triggered a lot of people and just the kind of hostility that he faced after that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he did eventually apologize, and I completely agree, like he did talk about like his actions speak for themselves and his jokes have changed and his comedy has changed. But I feel like that one reaction that he did kind of just cost him so much. And I feel like that's kind of the problem with outrage culture, isn't it? Like, we're not even affording even a tiny bit of leniency to a person when it comes to things like this. I mean, it's just you're in the spotlight, and then even a tiny thing that you say or do can come back and bite you. So I think
that's a really good point, Danielle. Guys, we're going to take a super quick break. We'll be right back.
I'm going away. Look into my eyes. The last Sunday of every month from 11 to 5. I want you here with me.
All right, I'm gonna do it, Rom. I'm about to spit in this mic like freestyle elfin, you know?
Okay. Wait, hold on. Does this make sense?
No, but who cares? All right, let's go. Finally, we. You're not even gonna last. All right. Victoria's pretty good, not bad festival, fountain, just back from France. Montreal? What the f***?
It's a script.
I couldn't even... What? Victoria's pretty good, not bad festival. Fountain just back from France. What are you even saying here? Oh, you're trying to say these are the things featured in this one. You should probably specify that. Because even a f***ing elf couldn't understand that, okay?
Think you can do better than an elf? At CITR, we want to have a variety of voices on the air. Want to write scripts? Do some voice acting? Broadcast your creativity? Volunteer with the CITR Production Department. No experience? We can also train you in everything required. Send an email to psas@citr.ca to learn more. And don't wait to get your voice on the air.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to CITR at 101.9 FM. We currently have Jackie Heffart on the line. Jackie, can you hear me?
Hi there.
Hi. How are you doing today?
I'm good.
Thank you so much for being on our show today. So, Jackie, we've been talking about outrage culture for the past half hour or so. And it's my understanding that you've been a comic in Vancouver for the past 4 years. Is that right?
Yeah, something like that. That sounds about right.
Cool. And also, Jackie, we have Danielle, Jasmine, and Carol in the studio.
Hello.
Hi, Jackie.
Hello.
So they're going to be like kind of jumping in every now and then. So just tell us about what your experience has been like with comedy and with the surgence, if you will, of outrage culture and political correctness. How has that affected comedy, do you think, in your opinion and your experience?
Yeah, I would say that the pretty large question that I'm only really well suited to take part part of. So what I would say is, I think, you know, I mean, even the term PC culture, it's from the 90s, right? So this isn't any kind of new trend, and using the word PC to shut people down is also nothing new. And so what's new, or what's slightly different, even in the past 4 years in comedy broadly and in Vancouver specifically, are the ways and the ways that a bunch of other trends are sort of coalescing. So, of course, like the Me Too movement has had a big impact on the scene in town in ways we could talk about on a whole other show. But I mean, I think, you know, I think you get a certain kind of type of person who is drawn to comedy because, in essence, there aren't really any rules. The only rule is really that you're talking and everyone else is listening, and that draws a certain kind of person. In fact, it actually draws every kind of person. And so within that, a lot of people are encountering people that they would normally never otherwise encounter in their daily lives.
Right.
That's certainly been my experience. And so that's like a little petri dish of a lot of really opinionated people coming together to try to tell stories, essentially, about what they think merits talking about. And, I mean, if there was ever a recipe for conflict and difference of opinion, it's that.
Right. And speaking of conflict and difference of opinion, just before we called you, we were actually talking about the Kevin Hart controversy. And we were really curious about what your opinion was on or is on that kind of whole fiasco.
Yeah, I actually have a really a rarely tight opinion on that, which is my take is really influenced by an article written by the podcaster and writer Ira Madison III. He recently wrote in The Hollywood Reporter, basically right after Kevin Hart had appeared on Ellen's show, basically calling out Ellen for putting him on the show. And I think what happened for me in learning about and reading his response to this controversy was it shifted my opinion. So previously I had sort of thought, oh, Kevin Hart, I mean, isn't he just sort of some kind of, like, whatever guy, and like, you don't even really need to care about him or whatever. Like, people like him, it's fine, you know, and then, like, oh, I guess he's been sexist in the past, like, big surprise, or he's been homophobic, like, whatever, right? And then part of me was also sort of like, you know, whoever we is, tend to hold men of color to a much higher standard than white men, and so I was sort of like, let's just focus on other things. You know what I mean? I was kind of like, maybe we can just ride this one out and not have to worry about it too much. But then him going on Ellen, it brought a different angle to it. And hearing Ira come out against Ellen to say, to sort of also, you know, sort of talk about how he thinks Kevin Hart is also trash, brought to light to me the criticism that, in fact, what Kevin Hart is doing is not, he's not criticizing Kevin Hart's comedy, and he's not pointing out that people were criticizing Kevin Hart's comedy. He's pointing out that people are criticizing tweets from 2012, it's not that long ago. I mean, it's long enough ago that maybe some of us are like, it doesn't matter, but, like, we're talking about violent tweets, about, like, hurting his child. So it's a lot of, like, he also sort of just, like, tweets back at people, like, really derogatory, homophobic language on the regular, and so there's lots of receipts for that.
Right.
And I think the thing for Ira is that, like, for Ellen, some sort of, like, I consider her to be mainstream, but a lot of people consider her to be sort of left or PC or progressive. It just sort of depends where you're standing, really. You know, for her to sort of absolve him of whatever sort of crimes he's alleged to have committed politically or socially, it doesn't take into account, like, young black men of color who are essentially the ones who are like who Kevin could have come out and spoken up for.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, Ira's point as well is just that, like, actually Kevin hasn't ever apologized. He's only ever acknowledged having acknowledged that he tweeted or that things are different now than they were then, which, while true, mm-hmm. like, Vulture did an entire story about how there actually are no, there is no record anywhere of him having ever apologized for mm-hmm. any of this. Mm-hmm. It's like, it could have been really interesting for him to sort of say, like, listen, I'm going to do some reflecting on, like, the way in which my unintentional or my, like, instinctual or my, like, unprocessed homophobia is, like, tied up with my masculinity, and I'm going to, like, work with gay men, and I'm going to, like, try to figure this out and become a better or become an ally or whatever. Like, he could have done that, but instead he's like, I'm being attacked, this is all about me, like, this is, you know, I mean, I just feel like he's made a bad choice, kind of like Aziz Ansari. Like, I feel like these people have made bad choices where they didn't need to be canceled, as you say. And so for me, I actually feel like, okay, well, screw that guy and screw like, you know, thank you, next. Like, let's get a different Oscars host. Who cares? And I think that, I don't think anyone is like, you know, I think this type of elevated position mm-hmm. of Oscar host is like a really great opportunity mm-hmm. for someone to be, to even take a chance at apologizing for some bad behavior or like be a good example. And I think he just continually is missing that opportunity. So that's how I feel about that.
Yeah, thanks for sharing. This is Jasmine you're hearing, and I agree with everything you said. I think it was no mistake that he chose to appear on Ellen, of course, you know, America's favorite lesbian, to sort of deliver these comments and for her to absolve his behaviors. I think among the LGBTQ plus community, I think it wasn't very well received because it's this idea that, you know, marginalized groups are homogenous and, you know, one person can speak for the whole.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I know a lot of people were a little bit upset about that when she sort of gave her endorsement. And I agree mm-hmm. with you that maybe the way that he chose to go around the apology, right, not to just not admit to his wrongdoings and acknowledge the learning moment that he could have had, I think that's definitely where he went wrong with this whole thing and perhaps why he's still not named the Academy Award host, because I think people still are ultimately upset by this. I was just wondering, in your experience being in the comedy world in the last couple of years, how do you think comedy has really changed due to, like, in response to political correctness? How do you think, like, what are our jokes different? Are we laughing at different things now?
I mean, I think that question makes it seem like comics care about political correctness. And what I really think is actually audiences that care.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think comics are a giant group, and I am not their representative. They would not vote for me. I was recently called a feminazi by another female comedian. So, like,
oh, wow.
I kicked her off stage for being racist, so that's what she gets. But I stand by my actions. but, you know, so I think that, you know, even if, like, whenever people try to sort of charge me with being PC, I just sort of ask, like, what is it that you mean by that? Because to me, I'm just trying to be, like, a nice, decent person, you know? Like, I'm trying to be good and thoughtful and empathetic, and I'm trying to understand and change where I can, and just like constantly be learning and have an approach to both my comedy and my way of living that is open, right? And trying not to be a dick, right? I think it's not that hard. Like, actually, I think it's not that hard, and I think that it's possible to it's certainly possible to have comedy that isn't, as they say, I don't know if this is like an expression that's gone out or whatever, but punching up rather than punching down. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, if you're going to sort of make fun of things or institutions or people, they should have more power than you rather than less. This is the concept of punching up, not punching down. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, broadly speaking, things are, like, I don't know, I guess better in a way if you're talking about people not being as, like, sort of heinous or terrible. But, like, it's not like there's the comedy scene. Mm-hmm. Like, that's one thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's, like, every single night in Vancouver, there's really several shows you could go to. Mm-hmm. And even if you just sub-select the genre of stand-up comedy, which is, again, a completely different world than sketch comedy and a completely different world than improv comedy, the stand-up scene is the one I know the best, and even that I sort of, like, have ostracized or separated myself from and created my own room because I don't feel comfortable there. So it's possible that it's constantly changing and I'm just not part of it anymore because I've removed myself in a lot of ways from a lot of the places I don't enjoy being. And that being said, like, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, I had a really good friend who was also a stand-up, and I would go to her sets a lot of the time, and I would start a timer at the beginning of the show. Like, I would start my phone and just press stop the first rape joke I heard. Because it was, like, really common even 6 years ago for people to just make rape jokes. I mean, people do it all the time now. I mean, I think sometimes people don't understand that dropping the soap is a rape joke. Like, I think there's just so much that people don't really think about in terms of these everyday expressions that we have that, like, seem like they're kind of funny. But in reality, if you think about it, the origin is actually something that's trying to make fun of someone or demean someone or sort of, like, reiterate or reify that they're somehow inferior or less than. And so, you know, I mean, you could do the same now with fat jokes. I mean, like, it's almost impossible to make it through a comedy show almost anywhere without someone making a fat joke. The world we live in is constantly becoming more and more sensitive to what offends people, and I think it's great, actually, because I just think the more thoughtful we are, the more interesting we become. and I think it's fair to say that there's less and less of an audience for that type of comedy, although, you know, certain mainstream comedy establishments would probably prove otherwise. But
sure. I really agree with that.
It's getting better, but yeah.
No, and I mean, what you said earlier about, you know, the more thoughtful we are, the more interesting we become. I mean, yeah, I think we all here can really resonate with that. Hey, Jackie, thanks so much for being on here with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Jackie.
Oh, so happy. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, take care. You have a nice day now.
Thanks.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
All right, that was Jackie Heffard, Vancouver-based comic and artist. Guys, we're going to take a short break. This was quite intense, all of this. I'm going to play you one of my favorite songs by singer Pratik Kuhad, and it's called Tum Jab Pass. And then after that, we're going to come back and talk about Bryan Cranston. See you in a bit, guys.
Say
Hello, everyone. So that was Tum Jab Pass by my favorite singer, Pratik Kuhad. You're listening to Intersections at CITR at 101.9 FM. So far, we've been talking about outreach culture. We also spoke to Jackie Heffart, who's a Vancouver-based comic. And we don't have a lot of time left on the show, but I really, really want to talk about Bryan Cranston. Do either of you want to kind of set the scene for those of us who haven't heard about it? Okay, I'm getting a lot of no's from from Carol, Jasmine, and Danielle here. So essentially, with Bryan Cranston, he played a paraplegic in the movie The Upside, and he got a lot of flack on Twitter for considering the fact that he's an able-bodied man and he was representing or playing a disabled person. And the flack was because the whole outrage was because you know, why didn't they find a disabled person to play a disabled actor? That was what it was. It was a matter of representation and a matter of identity, and that was kind of at the root of the outrage on Twitter.
And yeah, I think also Cranston's own comments on this, when he was kind of asked about it, he just went on like, oh, this is not a problem about inclusion or representation, this is just a business decision. Mm-hmm. I think that kind of got him into like way more trouble with
saying it was a business decision?
Yeah, saying it was a business decision when, I mean, for a lot of people, it is not a business decision. Maybe for you and maybe for people inside Hollywood it is. Mm-hmm. But for a lot of people, like for these communities, people who are fighting for these rights and who have to go through that struggle every day, it is not just a business decision. I think you should have been more careful when choosing his words. And so that's kind of the whole argument. But yeah, I would love to hear your thoughts on that, Jasmine and Carol. You guys might want to jump in.
Yeah, I think... I know his statement said something to the effect of acting is, you know, pretending to be something other than what you are, right? It's this idea that you are pretending to be someone who you're not. You're playing a part. But I think that's a little problematic when it comes to playing people who are disabled, because you are probably taking that part away from an actor who actually is disabled. because the truth of the matter is they cannot play a part that Bryan Cranston can play. Bryan Cranston can play whatever he wants, right? He can be an athlete, he can be a paraplegic, he can be anything across the board, but somebody who is not able-bodied like Bryan Cranston does not have access to those opportunities. And for me, that is sort of the crux of the issue. And the same goes for cisgendered people playing transgender characters. You are essentially robbing those roles from people who do not have as many opportunities as cisgendered, able-bodied actors.
Yeah, going on that, the Bryan Cranston scandal, if you will call it, reminded me of, you know, Scarlett Johansson and Emma Stone and all those white actors who played non-white characters. It's just interesting to me how, like, these issues are, I feel like, only important to marginalized peoples, and it's kind of sad how a lot of people don't really see why we're so angry about this. And Bryan, like Jasmine said, he's a white cis man who has a lot of these opportunities. He doesn't really face these barriers in Hollywood that a lot of his people counterparts who are of color face on the daily. I mean, I feel like the directors, like, they focus on who's famous, who's going to bring in all the money, as Daniela said, but also I just wonder, like, do they even care to bring in or even have disabled actors for auditions? Like, do they even want to give those people opportunities? What do you think about that, actually?
I think that's a really good point. I mean, my take on the whole thing is, like, when I first heard about this, I was kind of like, oh, does this have to be a big deal? And Trevor Noah said this one thing on his Daily Show, which I kind of resonated with initially, where he said, if you get the person to play the actual person, then it's a documentary and it's not a movie. But having said that, I feel like it's incredibly important to be given a shot to audition, because and we've talked about this earlier, but Jasmine, and you said this as well, the only roles that disabled people or people in a wheelchair, for example, can get are roles that, you know, portray disabled people. So It's definitely important that they get a shot to audition. But the reason this is such a gray area for me is because there's so many other factors. Like, financially speaking, like, the director is he's going to want to get someone who is going to bring in money. Like you said, Carol, that's how Hollywood is. It's a superficial industry. It's financially motivated. And even if they do give a shot to disabled actors, I mean, they're going to end up picking someone who is able to act well, disabled or not. So I think there's that aspect. And also, depending on the disability, I mean, you know, acting is incredibly hard. It's long hours. And is the director willing to kind of, you know, have medical assistance on site all the time? He has to make everything, for example, ramp accessible. And these are all things that, you know, they cost money. And it's just that affects if a disabled actor can actually, you know, be a part of the movie. And more than anything, and Danielle, I can see you're itching to jump in, but I just have to get this out. I feel like all of this outrage is kind of wasted, because the more important thing to me is I'm not going to speak on behalf of disabled people, but I feel like I don't think that representation in Hollywood is as important as, for example, more practical matters that affect disabled people in their day-to-day lives. Like, I mean, on UBC itself, like, not every building is accessible, it's not ramp accessible or, like, wheelchair accessible. And to me, those are, like, more real things and more, like, realistic situations that are actually affecting people, disabled people, in their day-to-day lives. Like, I don't think, oh, like, I'm not able to play this character that Bryan Cranston played. I just don't feel like that's on the forefront of their consciousness as much as, hey, I'd like to be able to get to the hospital and there's no ramp for me to kind of use. So to me, that's, like, a more important issue.
Yeah, so it looks like we're kind of running out of time, so I just want to leave our listeners with one last thought. I know we've been talking a lot about outrage culture and what it means to be more politically correct in our culture now. What I want to say is that I'm ultimately grateful for the rise of political correctness, and that's for a lot of reasons. To me, political correctness simply means that people cannot get away with being jerks anymore, and I know that Jackie touched on this. We can't be jerks to people who are from marginalized backgrounds or have marginalized identities. It means that we are not laughing at the same jokes or mocking marginalized people's existences the way that we used to, and that is ultimately a very good thing. It means that our culture is moving away from those intolerant and toxic behaviors. And sadly, our shift towards political correctness has garnered a lot of resistance, which means that people are resistant to change. But all I have to say is that, in my opinion, those conversations are the ones that need to be had.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for everyone who tuned in today. Thank you, Carol, Jasmine, and Danielle. And thank you, Jackie, for having a little phone interview with us today. Guys, this is Intersections at 101.9 FM. Thanks so much for tuning in, and we'll see you the week after next. Have a great evening, guys.
Bye.